of most in the world into hell. I looked at Frederic. As if he could read my innermost thoughts, he said, I regret nothing. Nor did I. When we arrived home, I was still shivering. Rosalie heated water and I bathed in the tub. I was reminded of that horrible woman Elise who had come from France to steal Justine's child. I slipped beneath the water as Elise had done and studied the ceiling until I came up sputtering. I hated rules and law and morals that were twisted into whatever people wished them to be. I didn't step out of the tub until the water was tepid. By then, I had come up with a plan. My father always said that I thought like a man, and perhaps there was some truth in that comment. I did not relish the role of sitting idly by with my needlework and baking, seeing to the children while the world made decisions all around me. I went to my desk to draw up my proposal to present to Frederic. We would go over the Reverend's head and petition the Grand Rabbi in Denmark for the legal right to wed. Such things were not done. We would insult both the Reverend and our entire community. We would make them look powerless and small in the eyes of the Grand Rabbi in Denmark. But this island was small, that was the truth, and the people around us were nothing more than tiny figures when viewed from above. We had no other choice. Surely God would see that and would bless our endeavors. I had a flicker of belief inside me. Frederic wrote the letter and read it aloud. I approved the sentiments within. The flicker grew brighter. I began to pray silently in the garden. Perhaps we had not been forsaken, and if we could address God more directly, he might hear us. We went over the letter several times that week, examining each word until at last it was done. Frederic took it to the post office, and I waited outside, my cloak covering me, though the air was warm. Sending our letter was not unlike creating a bomb that could explode at any time, anywhere. Frederic came down the stairs of the post office. The deed was done and could not be undone. He was so young. Just looking at him tore at my heart. That night in our bed, we did not speak, but instead embraced each other as we had the first night we were together when I thought he might die of fever. Perhaps we were both in a fever to act so rashly and insult our entire community. The letter that would change our fate was on its way to Denmark, and we were safe in our bed. I could think of little but that pale envelope traveling across an ocean, innocent, mere parchment and ink, until it was opened and read. Then our lives would never be the same. We would be considered traitors willing to betray our own people. The only one who wouldn't judge what I'd done was Justine. She understood love. What destroys you saves you, she had told me. Now I knew what she meant. My love for Frederic would ruin me, yet I wouldn't have it any other way. I began to observe things I hadn't taken note of before. Perhaps I'd been naive, or possibly I simply hadn't wished to see the cruelty around us, but it was there, on every street of Charlotte Amalia, and out in the countryside where the manor houses stood. Danish law decreed there was to be no more slavery, but those slaves already owned were still considered property. They were given Sundays off as if they were free people and could sail to a neighboring island to visit family, but when they returned on Monday, they were slaves once more. On our island, more than half of the African population was free, and that included most everyone who had a European father, but the rest were enslaved, mere property. I now had a better sense of how an individual's fate could be based on arbitrary rulings invented by men for profit of one sort or another. If I had lived in Denmark, I could have married Frederic. It was a larger community, and we could have disappeared into the outskirts of a city and do as we wished. Here I was a sinner. I had been blind to the pain of others until I had my own burden to carry. Now when I saw slaves in the market, I didn't know how they contained themselves. They were denied rights to their own lives, their own flesh and blood and breath. To beg for salvation and find none, and still have faith, was a mystery to me. I felt abandoned by God and by my people. Although I lit the candles, I did not say prayers on Friday nights anymore. I left that to my beloved, who still believed. Our son was less than a year old when the Grand Rabbi allowed us to wed with a legal document from the highest authority. Our wedding contract came from Denmark. It was a plain document, but it carried weight because it was signed by the ultimate voice in our congregation. In the paper, the Tidende, the next day, November 22, 1826, we paid to have an announcement printed and had the same announcement published in the St. Thomas Times. By license of His Most Gracious Majesty, King Frederick VI, they had become married according to the Israelitish ritual. We thought we could resume our lives and would no longer be considered outcasts. But the next day, when Frederick came home from the store, he had the new issue of the Tidende. "You don't want to look at this," he said. He tried to burn it in the stove, but I took it from his hands and read the announcement page. We were denounced by the congregation, who proclaimed we had married without the knowledge of the rulers and wardens of the synagogue, nor was the ceremony performed according to the usual custom. Our own people wished to punish us for going over the reverend's head. Once Jews started doing as they pleased outside the confines of the law, anything could happen. The synagogue might fall, the world as they knew it might disappear. The Danish government might be incited to act against us, and then a new onslaught might begin. And so the president of the congregation had gone to the newspaper, making us a scandal for the whole island to view. Letters had gone out from the reverend secretary to the chief rabbis in London and Amsterdam and Copenhagen. Protestants, Africans, Catholics, people in every reach of society had read about us, for in every kitchen we were the topic of discussion. The good man and the enchantress. Some people said I was made of molasses. One bite and you couldn't get enough. They said I turned into a bird during the day and flew over the island looking for my enemies so I might soar down and peck at them, and if I grew angry enough, I might leave sparks of fire on their roofs. Then at night, I became a woman again, they said, slipping into my man's bed. Before he could call out to God to protect him, before he could escape, I had my arms around him. The viciousness of the attack against us in such a public forum was unheard of. My children needed to be protected. The older ones had already heard grumblings about us in town and in the store, but we kept the seriousness of the situation from the younger ones. Rosalie, I knew, pitied me. "It doesn't matter what people say," she told me. "He's already your husband." Rosalie understood wanting what you could not have, as Mr. Enrique had a wife on another island and could not marry her. But I was not as patient or as tolerant as she was. The green bitterness growing inside me was a dangerous flower. I could taste the tang of sourness it gave off, like arsenic, the poison left out for the mongooses sent here from the other side of the world. In a few weeks, letters began to arrive from the Petit family as they tried to gain control of the business. They were half-owners after all, having inherited what had once been my father's holdings along with my first husband's estate. The St. Thomas newspaper had been sent to them, and they were in shock, afraid their assets on our island would disappear if left in our hands. Frederick put the letters away, but I found them. The family had written that he was too young, and they'd been mistaken to send him. He was now obligated to give over control and send the ledgers and records of the business to France. But he did no such thing. He may have been young, but he was stubborn, a believer in doing what was morally right, even if it meant breaking the law. We soon received a letter from the congregation stating that they had begun a correspondence with the rabbi in Copenhagen and had asked that the king's court undo our marriage, which they stated was granted outside of Jewish law. We were under siege. Frederick and all the children fell ill with some mysterious sickness that made them unable to eat. I boiled herbs and made a tea from berries and ginger, and they began to heal. But the case against us went on. Because of the pressure from the community, the king's court suddenly reversed itself, declaring our marriage illegal, stating that we had not presented ourselves as Jews when we asked for permission to marry. I was officially a sinner, damned by the Grand Rabbi. Now women spat on the street when they saw me. I began to carry an apple inside my shawl, not out of hunger, but because it was the fruit of our family, and I believed it might ward off any curses set against me. Soon I stopped going out. I locked myself in the house and wore black again. Rosalie came to my bedside. "Don't let them win," she told me. "They have. They think they have. But they can't if you don't allow it." Still, I stayed in bed for nearly a week until Rosalie said I had to let her change the bed linen. When I got out of bed, she dumped a pitcher of water on my head. I screamed and stood there sputtering and waterlogged while my youngest children laughed at me. "If you can't wake up, then we'll do it for you," Rosalie said. I was sopping and stunned, but something inside me awoke. The self I was, the woman who knew what she wanted and what she must have. I threw my arms around Rosalie in gratitude. Then I dressed and readied myself for the world, driven by anger and desire. But perhaps that is always what drives a woman to fight back. I had my sons go into the hills and cut down armfuls of flowers from the flamboyant tree. I took these with me and went to the cemetery. I wrapped the branches in wet muslin so they might bloom with a deeper scarlet shade. Dusk was near. The blue-tinted light sifted over me as I prayed at the grave of Esther Petit. I left her armfuls of the flowers she favored. Then I looked for the grave of the Reverend's first wife. I had brought her something special as well, an apple from the tree my father had been sent long ago from France, the one that had lost most of its leaves in the heat of the fire but still bore fruit. I begged the Reverend's first wife to tell her husband, who was still on earth, to let us be. Perhaps he'd never known love himself in his marriages, but surely even he should be able to see it when it was right before his eyes. We went on about our lives as if we were the only people in the world. I found several white strands in my hair, and Justine pulled them out at the root. We sat on her porch and watched the sea, and waited for what would happen next, as we used to do when we were girls, when our lives seemed like a story we ourselves could tell. I still dreamed of Paris, only now when I dreamed I was walking through the Tuileries, and I was searching for someone, driven by panic, running through the rain. Some nights I couldn't breathe, and Frederic woke me, assuring me that he would be with me always and that I needn't search for him. I suppose I had been talking in my sleep. I held him close and kissed him until I couldn't think. When we wed, we did not mention our intentions to the congregation or to the elders or to the reverend who had made us stand in the rain. We had no license to wed, but we did so anyway. The small gathering was held in the parlor of Monsieur de Leon's large house. He had given a speech at my first wedding and had not abandoned me, even though he made it clear he did not approve of my choices. He had helped me out of respect for my father, inviting 10 men who had been bar mitzvah to be our witnesses. All of them wore black, as if attending a funeral. De Leon was a learned man, as my father had been, and he spoke the prayers the reverend should have said. The 10 pious men were uncomfortable with the proceedings, but they murmured, "Amen." I knew that as soon as the service was over, Monsieur de Leon would not wish to see me or speak to me lest he be cast out of the community. That night I was a married woman. As a marriage gift, Frederic presented me with a copy of Radoute's illustrated book of roses, Choix des plus belles fleurs, printed in France. No other man would know I wanted that book more than anything, more than diamonds or pearls. We lay in bed and turned the pages. The heavy paper was scented with salt from the volume's journey across the sea. "Are you happy with it?" my husband said to me. I hesitated to say what I felt, for I loved him too much and was afraid I would be punished for doing so. Still, I said, "Yes," and we didn't leave our chamber for 12 hours. Rosalie teased me about that every day afterward. "Married people don't act like you do," she said. By the time our second son, Moses Alfred, was born 3 years later, his name was entered into the synagogue books beneath his brother's name. This time I did not have to break in and do it myself. The reverend secretary made the entry. Rosalie thought it was perhaps because I named this second baby for my father, who was so beloved in St. Thomas, and for the patriarch who had brought our people to freedom. Frederic believed it was because the congregation was tired of the scandal. "We had outlasted them," he said. He laughed and kissed me and asked who among them could deny we were anything other than an old married couple with or without the Reverend's blessing. My husband and Rosalie could think what they liked. I knew the truth. If the congregation was no longer set against us, it was due to the Reverend's wife, the one who was dead and buried, whose ghost I honored, and the living one I'd petitioned for help. Still, we were outcasts, and we lived our lives as such. On Saturdays, Frederic said prayers in the garden with the boys, and then we went to Market Square, where people who were not of our faith spent their free day. There were over a dozen nationalities listed in St. Thomas, and so many foods to choose from in the marketplace on Saturdays that it was like a carnival. I always craved Spanish food, eggs and sardines and olives, and we had Malbi, a drink of fermented bark made from the Malbi tree, not alcoholic but laced with cinnamon, delicious when you'd acquired a taste for it. The Jewish businesses, including our own, were closed on Saturdays, and all shops were closed between 12 and 2 every day. So we often went swimming on Saturday afternoons, trekking down to the beach where the turtles came one day a year. I went in the water in my underclothes since I was with my children. Hannah was always there watching over them. Now 13, she was better at mothering than I was. I thought she must have learned what a kind heart was in the 12 days her mother had lived. Her pale hair was gold in the sunlight, and I prayed she would have an easier time in this world than most women did. When she came to sit beside me, I felt her mother's love around us both as leaves fell from the trees, even though there was no breeze and the air was still. In the year 1830, our third son was born on July 10th. Justine and Rosalie were with me, which was fortunate, for this was not an easy birth. This baby had a mind of his own and didn't care how much pain he caused me. I choked on my own screams, and Frederic and the children were ushered from the house. It was not until much later that Justine admitted that both she and Rosalie thought they might lose me, for the labor lasted 3 days and 3 nights, and every hour was an agony. I had begun talking to the spirits. When Justine and Rosalie realized I was in deep conversation with the first Madame Petite, as if I were planning to join her, they became so frightened they took a vow that they would do all they could to save me should it come to a choice. They would let the baby go and pull me back to life. I knew nothing of this, of course. I was in a fevered state and didn't notice that Rosalie was crying. I was burning up as if I were overtaken by something stronger than myself, and the aching I felt was different than it had been with any other birth. Before he appeared, this child was difficult, intent on causing me pain. Yet when he was born, I loved him best, precisely because of our struggle, a secret I kept from all the others. I had named him Abraham, after his father's first name, then Jacobo, after Jacob from the Bible, then Camille, to always remind him that he was French. He was most like me and had my faults. He did not sleep but cried through the night, just as Madame Halévy said I had done. When I went to hold him, he pulled away from me. He was perfect, a beautiful baby, but I wondered if his sleeplessness was due to an illness. Even beneath Justine's tender touch, this baby seemed unsettled. When I hadn't slept for 2 weeks straight, and Jacobo wasn't gaining any weight, I knew what we must do. I asked Justine if she would come with me back to the herb man, though neither of us was certain he was still alive. He'd been ancient when we last saw him, and if people in town went to call on him, they did not say so, for such engagements were made to combat troubles and tragedies. It was the center of a hot green summer. Still, I bundled up the baby in a cotton blanket to ensure against chills. We brought a pitcher of lime water with us. I had gold coins with me as well, so this time I could pay the price for a cure. We were slower than we'd been when we were girls who ran through the hills chasing donkeys or being chased by them. We spotted some now, eating dried grass along the road. I wondered if Jean-Francois, once my children's pet, was among them. When I said so, Justine shook her head. If he is, you don't want to know. He'll just break your heart all over again for a creature that should be wild anyway. Still, I whistled and called out his name. All of the donkeys glanced up at us. Justine started laughing. See? She said. If he's among them, he's no different than they are now. You did yourself and him a favor when you set him free. But I saw the eyes of one of the donkeys set on me, and I knew. It was Jean-Francois, the pet I'd walked into the hills late one night that had tried to follow me home. Justine saw the look on my face. "Now you're going to cry," she declared. "Unlikely," I answered. I turned away so she wouldn't see my tears. In my arms, my baby was fretting. Justine looped an arm around my waist. "You have a soft heart," she said. "Don't worry. I won't tell anyone." We both laughed then. No one knew me the way she did, not even Frederic. Whoever knows you when you are young can look inside you and see the person you once were, and maybe still are at certain times. I went ahead and let myself cry, then pulled myself together. The light was yellow now, hotter. We went on to the herb man's house. Our route brought us past the waterfall that fell into a pool where tiny blue fish slipped through the shallows. I wished we could strip off our clothing and immerse ourselves in the cool water, but we continued on, past tangles of vines, some with thorns, some without. There was a hush here, and Jacobo was quiet, I think for the first time in his 2 weeks of life. We walked on, through the coils of greenery, light-footed, almost as if we were girls once more. There were ruins, a manor house from 100 years earlier, crumbling into stone dust, and stalks of sugar cane grew wild. At last we reached the clearing where the herb man had his hut. Someone was living there, that much was certain. There were embers in a little fire pit, and some pots and pans scattered about. Justine didn't know I had once come here myself to thank the herb man. She didn't know I had kissed him. She started to go into the house, but I said I would do it this time. I wasn't afraid. If anyone was to pay for a cure for my baby, it should be me. "Do you want me to ask for something for you, too?" I said before I went in. Justine's expression shifted and I saw her grief. "Ask him to get me back everything I lost. See if he can do that for me." I rapped on the door and was told to come inside. The baby was fussing, but only a little. I had to get used to the dark. I spied the herb man in his chair. He looked so old, as if he was already in another world. "Do you remember me?" I asked. He shrugged. It didn't matter. "Is that the problem?" He nodded at my baby. "He doesn't sleep or eat." I brought Jacobo closer so that he could be examined. The herb man opened the blanket and studied the baby's form. My son threw his arms up and cried with a deep voice. "He's strong," the herb man said. "He has no fever. He just has other things on his mind." "What other things?" I couldn't imagine what a baby might be thinking of other than sleep and milk and the warmth of his mother's arms. "He sees what you can't see." The baby had quieted and was staring into the herb man's eyes. "Maybe he sees my death. I wouldn't be surprised if he sees how I'll go out and lie in the grass and blink and be gone. I'll travel right up to the stars and look down at him. Or maybe he just sees the shadows on the wall." The herbalist signaled for me to wrap up my baby. As I did, he slowly got up and brought forth a bottle of a brown liquid made of soursop and powdered herbs. He gave me a bundle of soursop tree leaves to rub over the baby's blankets. The herb man was so old he could barely walk. I wondered how he fed himself, and I thought perhaps I should leave fruit and bread every week. He came to take the baby from my arms. "He'll sleep with one drop of this every night. Then he'll get used to sleeping. He will look forward to it. But it won't change who he is or how he sees." The herb man gave the baby a drop of the mixture to drink from his finger. My son made a face, but he closed his eyes. "Whenever you do this, let him hear your voice. Then he will know you will always be there for him. Speak now," he told me. I was so taken aback, I began to tell the first story that came to me, the one that had always terrified Aaron. Surely it was wrong to speak of werewolves in the presence of an infant, but I did. I murmured of how the old Danish families had to pay a price for their cruelty, how when the moon was full they felt their bodies would become covered with hair and their claws would come in. By the time I was done, my child was asleep. "He likes stories with teeth," the herbalist said happily. Another sign of his strength. It was then I noticed the pearls around the herbalist's neck, the ones my mother had sewn into the hem of her skirt when my parents fled Saint-Domingue, the ones my grandmother had brought when she escaped from Spain. Justine had paid for Frederick's life with them. The herb man caught me staring. "You like these?" he said, holding up the pearls. "I'm making sure the bad luck in them wears off." I took out a gold coin and put it on the table. It was too much for a sleep cure, and we both knew it. I explained that I wanted the pearls back. "Someone needs them," I said. "She wants to get back what she lost."
"You give them to her? You'll give her your luck, too," the old man said.
"Are you sure about that?" I said I was. I owed it to her. He took off the strand of pearls and gave them to me. They were so hot they burned my hand. I was about to put another gold coin on the table, but the herb man stopped me.
"What good will that do me where I'm going?" he said. "I like something more than coins."
So I kissed him, as I'd done before. We were halfway down the hill when I handed Justine the pearls. There were already clouds of mosquitoes hovering over the waterfall when we passed by. "You should have what was meant to be yours," I told my friend. Justine gave me a look, then she slipped the pearls around her throat and kissed me. I gave her my luck and was happy to do so. As we continued on the road, I held my child close so he would hear the sound of my voice, as the herbalist had bade me to do. I told him the story of the turtle woman who couldn't decide whether or not to be human, and of the fish who had the face of a horse, and of a donkey who had the name of a French boy and came running home to supper whenever he was called. By the time we reached our street, my baby was slumbering as if he'd never had any difficulty. On the night before 1 year ended and another began, there was a special celebration on our island, when the tired old year was swept away, a time when wrongs were forgotten and hope was restored. It was a rowdy party that included the entire city, and what was done on that night was overlooked, left unjudged. You could kiss a stranger on the street, drink all night, engage in a fistfight, gamble, run wild, and still be absolved of any wrongdoing. Sometimes I thought it was the only night when some people on our island possessed the ability to forgive in our unfair world. People of color and Europeans, the poor and the rich, some descended from royalty and others from slaves, flooded the streets to dance. Already many people of color were free on our island, and soon they would be granted the rights of citizenship and be welcomed into the Burgers Association so they could set up business, just as Jews would soon be granted the rights to marry non-Jews, though few would do so and dare face the congregation's wrath. On this one night, however, everyone was equal on the street. Some wore masks so they would not be recognized by their mothers or wives, or by neighbors who might reveal any trespasses committed and create a scandal. The celebration began at 4 in the afternoon and went on all night. Even the slaves were free to do as they pleased, dancing and forming into bands of musicians, with many playing the drums called gumbe. In our community, only men were allowed to attend this party, but I had never listened to rules. I hadn't even told Frederic where I was going. I had kissed him goodbye and left him to read over the ledgers. Rosalie promised to stay with the children until midnight, then she was leaving to be with Mr. Enrique. I wore the green dress Justine had sewn for me when I thought I would wear black for the rest of my life. I braided my hair, took off my rings, found a mask hidden in a bureau. My husband trusted me and asked no questions, which made me love him all the more. I would create still another scandal if anyone knew I went alone through the city doing as I pleased. I put my children to bed and went down the stairs in the dark. There was Justine waiting for me. We both slipped on our masks made of feathers so we could not be recognized. Justine was wearing my mother's pearls, the ones I'd bargained for with my good fortune. There were always men who chased after my friend, for even masked, she was clearly the most beautiful woman in the crowd. She paid no attention. Perhaps we had indeed changed places, and she no longer believed in love. She had one person in mind, her child, and that left no room for anyone else. People thought we were sisters and addressed us as such, and we laughed and drank rum at a stand on the street.
I'm the pretty sister, but you're the one who gets what she wants, Justine said.
It was true. I had 10 children and a man I loved. No matter what my problems were and how my own people shunned me, I was blessed by the many riches of my life.
The whole world starts again in a few hours. You're supposed to have hope tonight, I told Justine.
I do. I hope that the red-haired woman dies a terrible death. Such things should not be said aloud, but I understood and I joined her in this wish. We raised our glasses and drank to the French woman's death. I had no qualms about doing so. We wandered through the drunken crowd, past Glass Bottle Alley and Ding Alley, all places we weren't supposed to be. We went to a food stand, bought cups of guava berry rum, cheered the musicians, walked through town hand in hand. We were out till the stars began to disappear from the sky. Hours later, the fire started. A fight had begun, and a kerosene lantern had been kicked over. In moments, wooden buildings went up like straw. I was in bed with my husband when we heard what we thought was one of the children screaming. But it was the wind that had picked up and the cry of fire as one building after the other caught. Frederic was out of bed in an instant. He pulled on trousers and a shirt. I loved to see his broad shoulders and his muscular arms when he was dressing. I wished he would stay beside me and leave the fire to the others, but he wasn't a person who would recoil from the possibility of harm to himself. "Start pouring water around the house," he told me. "Don't leave the hill." I felt panicked when he went out. I called his name, but he was gone. I didn't care about anyone but him. There was a heaviness inside me, as if my life had left me. I went to the window to look for him, but he had turned the corner and had taken the steps down the hill, already on his way to the synagogue, where a bucket brigade had begun to wet down buildings. Every effort was made, with the men working even harder when the breezes came up, soaking every wall and roof. I woke Rosalie and we did the same with our home and store, with the help of the older children. The air was thick with sparks and smoke, but we worked away, our clothes drenched. I thought of Justine, alone at the harbor, pouring buckets of seawater on her porch and along the perimeter of her house. By then, flocks of birds were overhead in the dark sky, fleeing the smoke, taking wing on a course that led past Justine's house out to sea. The pelican, who had always nested on our roof, who I believed carried Adele's spirit, left that night when sparks fell into its nest. I felt an emptiness without that bird above me, there like one of the stars that rose above us in the sky. The fire raged for 2 days, during which time we stayed close to home, wetting down the street and garden with bucket after bucket. Our rain barrel ran dry, and I had to send the boys dashing to the harbor to fill buckets with salt water. I counted the minutes until they were back home, safe from the flames. Cinders stung our clothes and eyes. Birds that had waited too long fell from the sky, bodies smashed on the road, their feathers drifting through puddles. I climbed out onto the roof, and the children handed me buckets of green seawater to pour over the eaves. There was no birdsong, no chatter on the streets, no ship's horns, only something that sounded like a cry. For 2 days we barely ate or slept. Frederic had not returned. I felt I had lost half of myself, more than half, actually, for I was nothing without him. Many people had been killed or wounded in the fires, and over 1,000 buildings had burned to the ground. I mourned for our city, but there was only one person I waited for at the gate. My heart knotted with fear. My hair was loose, thick with ash. My hands had blistered from lugging pails of water with handles so hot from the fires they had burned marks into my palms. When my husband at last came home, he was black with soot. I didn't care but went to embrace him. I felt my heart had been returned to me. I wept but did not let him see me do so. I had to let him be himself, a young, hopeful man. I could not burden him with the depth of my love and how afraid I was when I thought I might lose him. I stepped away so that he might wash the fire off him. He stripped off his clothes and stood in the garden while he poured buckets of water over himself. Soon enough the ground was black. Even after he'd washed, when he came to bed, he smelled of smoke. "No one spoke to me," he told me. "They let me help, but when it was over and everything had burned down, they turned from me. Not a single man from the congregation greeted me by name." I heard the hurt and confusion in his voice, and I thought that whatever happened, whether our marriage was ever considered legal or whether we were forever outside the law, I would never trust anyone in our community. An outcast was an outcast, even when the tide turned. I would always be the woman who was a sinner. I could turn men into pillars of salt, enchant them to do my bidding, make them beg to come into my bed. My green-edged bitterness was running through my blood. Yet despite my hatred for those men who had turned their backs on Frederic, I was able to love my husband completely. He was such a beautiful man, both his physical self and the soul that he carried. That night in our bed, he lay beside me with ashes still threaded through his dark hair, his long arms twisted around me. The city was in ruins, with smoke rising from burned houses, and we were two people who had been scorned. But in truth, I felt more fortunate than most, despite having handed over my measure of luck to Justine. I thanked the women whose spirits walked in the trees above my head when I visited the cemetery. In the morning, when I looked into our garden, branches of our apple tree lay strewn upon the stones of the patio, the leaves burned off, but the bark was still green. This tree from France had survived both sea voyages and hurricanes. It had been transplanted whenever our family had to flee, the last time dug up with my own hands when I stole it from the garden of my parents' house. I did not think fire would be the end of it, although from that time onward, it gave fruit only once a year, more bitter than ever, but delicious when steeped in a mixture of equal parts molasses and rum. When my fourth son with Frederic was born, I named him Aaron Gustav, hoping my choice would cleanse that name, but it was likely a mistake. Justine refused to look at the baby, and later, when she relented, she called him Gus, which was the name of a goat that had belonged to one of our neighbors. Even I had to laugh at that. I now had 11 children, for I considered my stepchildren my own, though they were now grown. I still worried for Felix, the one who was in my womb when I stood on the Reverend's doorstep. He was fragile, quick to take a chill, very quiet with shining dark eyes. And then in the following year, I lost a baby who was even more fragile, a boy who arrived far too soon when I was by myself in the garden. I had a stab of pain, then crouched down as the pirates' wives must have done, alone and unaided. He arrived dead before he came to life, and so he could not be named or protected from Lilith. I felt robbed and told no one of my loss. It was only Frederic and myself at the funeral, which we could not have in the synagogue. There was a single gravedigger whom we hired, a man not of our faith. We went at dusk, that blue, empty time. I laid the child to rest beside my father, who I hoped would watch over him in the world to come, if such a thing existed. I did not weep, although my husband sobbed. When he knelt and cried out to God, I felt my bitterness burn inside me. We released the gravedigger and took up a shovel ourselves and buried our child together. Now our boy with no name would be among the spirits. In the year of 1833, the elders of our congregation agreed that our marriage was legal and wrote our union down in their book. It was there for everyone to see. We were officially husband and wife. I am not certain what changed, but perhaps we had been more of a scandal as outsiders than we would be as members of the synagogue. Frederic immediately began to go to services, but I declined. I waited for him in the garden on Saturdays, and we would sit together then, and he would say a prayer for me and for our children and our household. I did not expect God's forgiveness, for I had done as I pleased. Nor did I expect luck, for I had given mine away. I had done so in the hope that Justine would be granted good fortune, but she was still in her house by the sea, still in mourning. I had written several letters to Aaron, but had received no reply. I tried to make him understand the grief his actions had caused, and begged him to consider allowing Liddy to return. There was no response until, late one day, Frederick came to our rooms. It was the busy season, so I was surprised to see that he had left the store while Rosalie and I were preparing the Friday night dinner. My husband brought me into the garden where we could have some privacy. He looked worried, and so many thoughts went through my head that I felt a wash of relief when he gave me an envelope from France. When he'd gone to the post office, the letter had been waiting. "From your cousin, I assume," he said. I opened the letter with a paring knife left out in the yard. The blade was rusty and left a mark the color of blood. I examined the handwriting. "From his wife?" I did not read any more, but instead decided to bring the letter to its rightful recipient. I took Jacobo with me. He was then nearly 4, a quiet child who often refused to do as he was told. In truth, I still loved Jacobo more dearly than any of the others, though I hid the fact that I favored him. He was both clever and dreamy, interested in the adult world which the other children ignored. "You can help me carry a package," I told him. He always liked to be useful. We took some fruit and slices of the cassava bread that Rosalie had baked that morning and brought the food up into the hills before going on to Justine's. I wanted favor, and I hoped my gifts might bring this. We left the offerings in the doorway of the herb man's house. I saw signs of life, pots, pans, and a bucket of water. "Is this a werewolf's house?" my son asked. I had read him all my stories, and he liked to hear that one over and over again. But now his eyes were wide. "Oh, no," I told him. "A good man lives here. We leave him some food because he's very old." Another frightened child might hide behind his mother's skirts, but my son peered through a window. It was covered with 2 boards, with some meshing attached to keep the mosquitoes out. The herbalist was likely in bed or watching us, waiting for us to leave. There were some parrots in the tamarind trees, and the leaves shook down on us. "It's raining," Jacobo said, and he gathered the leaves and set them at the herb man's doorstep as yet another gift. We went along the path that seemed to change every time I took it. We came upon donkeys and crouched down to watch them. Jacobo was entranced. When I held a finger to my lips, he nodded and agreed to be silent so he wouldn't frighten the creatures away. "One of them is Jean-Francois," I whispered. My son shook his head. "Donkeys don't have names," he whispered back. He was very sure of himself even then. I should have known there would be trouble between us, for our temperaments were too alike. But instead I laughed and the donkeys scattered and we watched them disappear into the hills. There had been a terrible hurricane some months before, and many of the buildings at the harbor were still in bad shape. My husband had paid some men to fix Justine's roof and fashion new wooden shutters that she could close from the inside when bad weather struck. She had painted them blue and white. Many of the palm trees had been toppled, and they still lay on the side of the road. I had the letter tucked into the bodice of my dress. It felt heavy, like a stone. I held Jacobo's hand, but he broke away and ran to Justine's house, climbing up the steps 2 at a time, while I held my breath, frightened he might fall and be swept away to sea. There were many skilled tailors in our country. It was a useful trade on an island where sailors often needed to be fitted for entire new wardrobes. But no one's work was as fine as Justine's. She had learned her craft when she made my wedding dress, and then my morning dress, and then my spring green dress. She had made all of Liddy's clothes. Now she had begun her own elite business. There was a list of women waiting to purchase her handiwork. She was a talented seamstress, but even more important, she could imagine a dress like no other. She called each one by name, the Storm, for an inky silk creation she'd begun during the hurricane, when the wind swept inside her house. The Moth, pale gray linen from France, so luminous and lovely she hated to sell it to the ugly old woman who had commissioned it. Now she was working on Starlight, fashioned of silvery damask, a fabric that would reflect light into the wearer's face so that no one would be able to gaze away. Once again, for the old lady who didn't deserve such beauty. There was a spool of white thread beside Justine and handfuls of crystal beads. Jacobo loved to visit here and made himself right at home. Justine was like a dear auntie to him, and the truth was I was jealous. They talked about things I didn't care about, the color of the sea and the palm leaves, and rejoiced over how many shades of red there were. My boy went inside and lay down on Justine's bed, pulling the thin blue quilt over himself. Ever since he'd had a drink from the herbalist's potion, he'd been an excellent sleeper. Justine and I laughed to think of the time when he was an infant and kept me up all night with his screams. At last I handed Justine the letter. The sewing fell from her lap in a coil when she saw it. The needle she held pricked her skin and a single drop of blood fell from her finger. Later she would use a lime water paste to remove it from the fabric, but every time the ugly woman wore the dress in public and I saw her, I remembered this day. "It might be bad news," Justine said. I knew what she was thinking. A letter after all this time might mean Liddy was afflicted in some way. Perhaps she had died. It had been 10 years since she had been stolen, time enough for anything to happen. "You read it to me?" Justine was shivering as she thrust the letter back into my hands. I noticed there was a pelican nesting on the new roof, perhaps the one who had flown from my house during the night of the Old Year fire. My luck, I was certain, was now Justine's. Such thoughts gave me the courage to open the letter and read, though at first my heart was in my throat. "I have often thought of writing to you in the past, but will make this brief due to the circumstances. I thought you should know that your daughter had grown into a beautiful woman. On the trip to France, I feared she might die from a fever. She fell into a deep sleep, and when she woke, she remembered little, not even her own name. Now she is engaged to be married. She is still young and must wait 2 years before she is wed." I raised my eyes to see Justine weeping. She had cast away the dress she had been working on so that her tears wouldn't ruin the fabric. "Justine," I said. I put the letter down. She shook her head. "They almost killed her with their love. Go on. Read it." I thought of Elise in our bathtub, her red hair streaming down her back, her pale skin scattered with freckles cavorting in the water as if she were nothing more than a simple, mindless girl. Perhaps I learned that people were not always what they appeared to be from that time. "I beg you to be happy for the joy in her life, and not to despise me for giving her a better one than she might have had if she'd stayed on your island. I imagine you must curse me every day, but please know I have always loved her. I'm writing you this news in the hope that it can bring you happiness as well." We had both thought of Liddy frozen at the age when she was taken. She was a little girl to us, not a young woman engaged to be wed. Elise's monogram was imprinted in the letter paper. "We should burn this," I said. On this day the sea was smooth and glassy. It seemed a person could walk all the way across it on the backs of the turtles until she reached the shoreline of France and the salt flats of the ancient city of La Rochelle. I wished it were so, just as I wished I could give my friend back her daughter. I would have even given her one of mine, but such things were impossible. We went inside Justine's house and made a fongi pudding out of cornmeal for our dinner. We saved a bowl for Jacobo to have when his nap was through, but for now we left him to his dreams. This porridge had been Liddy's favorite meal when she was wrapped inside the life that should have been hers. We did not set a plate for her to help bring her back home, for people say such actions call to a person's spirit, and we feared we would disrupt the happiness she had found with the man she was to marry. But we burned the letter after we had eaten. We saw that the smoke was blue, a sign that the writer did not have long to live. Surely that was why my cousin's wife had written after all this time, as an attempt to free herself of her sins. Yet there was no regret in her message, no apology, not even any gratitude. If it were me, I would have indeed cursed her. But Justine simply poured water on the ashes to make certain any flaming sparks were drowned. We threw what was left into the sea. My son woke then, and he ran to us. But it was Justine he threw his arms around, not me.
Chapter 7. The Escape Artist. Charlotte Amalia St. Thomas, 1841. Jacobo Camille Pissarro, I wanted my freedom from the start. I did not wish to go to school and would have preferred to walk through the streets of the city, skirting the harbor, making my way to the shore so I could study waves, sand, birds, light. This was my library, the landscape around me, luminous and white-hot or starry and black. I liked to be with everyday people, watching them work, especially at the docks where there was a riot of color and a rush of great excitement every time a ship arrived. For that was the way the world came to us and woke us up with news and events and people. We had small lives here. Each group stayed to themselves, and people of our faith were very close-knit. My older brothers and sisters had all attended European schools, and several had left the island due to marriage. But we younger brothers did not attend the school at the synagogue, rebuilt from stone and brick after the fire that had burned it to the ground, nor did we go to any of the schools that non-Jewish Europeans attended. We were outcasts, and as far as I was concerned, this was good luck. So much the better. But my mother insisted that all children must be taught to read and write, and she brought us to the school run by the Moravians, missionaries from Denmark. The Moravians on St. Thomas had been funded 100 years earlier by the Danish princess Charlotta Amalia, the beloved wife of King Christian V, born in 1650, and it was her name that graced our capital city. My brothers and I were the only Europeans to attend the school, and at first the other students gawked and joked about us, but that didn't last long. We had to work too hard for there to be time for ridicule. We were taught in English, Danish, and German. At home, we spoke French, and I didn't know a word of these languages, so I sat there in a dream state. I wondered if this was how our dog, called Souris, meaning mouse, felt when my sisters would chatter to him. Souris was a descendant of one of the dogs brought here by pirates from Madagascar, common on our island, a breed that was white and fluffy as cotton, but tough when it came to chasing after rats and lizards. My sisters, especially Delphine, liked to dress him up in a baby's bonnet and have him sit on a chair for tea. And my father, who was easygoing, allowed this. My father loved peace and quiet. He was most interested in figures and ledgers. He was soft-spoken, though, and had a big heart. I think when my mother's back was turned, he gave my sisters biscuits to share with Souris and laughed along with them at the dog's antics. Delphine was his favorite. She was so pretty it was hard to say no to her. It seemed far easier to say no to me, for when I begged my father to let me escape from hours wasted at school, he told me every man should be educated. I knew he would not go against my mother. He never would. Luckily, at the new school, I sat beside a girl named Mariana King, who grinned at my confusion and whispered in French, "Pretend you know what they're saying, and eventually you will." This turned out to be true, although it took months for the miracle of my understanding to occur. During that time, everyone came to believe I was an idiot, and perhaps some of them thought that was why I was in this school with people of color, rather than in the school run by the synagogue like other boys of my faith. But my idiocy in matters of scholarship was not the reason I was there. Something had happened years before I was born, and people of our own faith were not friendly to us. We had not been made to feel welcome to worship in the synagogue. I had once or twice sneaked up the marble step so I might slip through the gated courtyard to peer inside. I saw the mahogany cabinet that was home to the Torahs, the scrolls of our law, and the huge tablets with the rules of Moses inscribed upon them. There was a domed ceiling, and at night the house of worship was lit by candlelight, so that the ceiling glowed as if it were the firmament. Blessed be he that cometh in the name of the Lord. But I had come out of curiosity and wonder rather than drawn there by faith. Our family was not invited to holiday dinners, parties, funerals, or weddings. I knew that my parents had offended the reverend and a scandal had ensued. My mother never once admitted this to me, but I'd heard gossip, and my older brothers had told me they'd been born before my parents had been officially married. I found this difficult to believe. Perhaps my family's standing was fueled by the fact that no one liked my mother. Only her maid, Rosalie, defended her headstrong ways. Rosalie had cause to favor my mother, for it was my mother who had insisted that my father hire a solicitor to search for his manager's wife on another island. In doing so, he had discovered that this wife had died 10 years earlier. Mr. Enrique was therefore free to marry Rosalie. For that reason alone, Rosalie was loyal, and though they belonged to different societies, the two were faithful to one another. Tell one a secret, and it was as good as telling the other. My mother had arranged to hold Rosalie's wedding in the garden of the house where my mother had grown up, opposite the cottage where Mr. Enrique and now Rosalie would live. She rented it from the new family in residence without bothering to mention it was not a Jewish wedding, but rather a marriage for African people. The new owners of the house closed their shutters and went out for the evening. Because of this, they missed how ethereal their garden became on the wedding night. Enchanted, lit by candlelight. The music was wonderful, flutes and the drums. We were the only Europeans invited. There was dancing until all hours, and my brothers enjoyed watching the women dressed in their finery. But I preferred to be in the back of the garden, where I could examine the pink flowers of the bougainvillea growing up the stucco walls in huge bunches. There was an ancient lizard beneath a hedge that barely moved when I studied his form. I sketched with a stick in the dirt, trying to capture the outlines of a century plant with huge gray-green leaves. Mr. Enrique worked with my father. On this night, he was wearing a formal suit and vest ordered from Paris, a gift from my mother. He surprised me when he came into the garden. He was now a married man, and perhaps he needed a quiet moment to think through his new standing in life. He was at least 20 years older than his bride, respected by my family and by his community. "Marriage is a lot of noise," he said, but he looked pleased. My mother had told me that if Mr. Enrique hadn't saved my grandfather, I wouldn't be alive, so I was a little in awe of him. "A piece of paper doesn't mean anything," the new groom went on. "Your mother knows that." From early on, I was aware that just because something was a rule, it wasn't necessarily fair. My mother glared at other women of our faith on the street, for they never greeted her. And when they came to shop in our store, there was no conversation. However, the love between my parents was unlike what I saw between other married couples, who were dutiful toward one another, often referring to each other as Madame and Monsieur after decades of marriage. My parents could not restrain their emotions. Sometimes I heard murmuring and laughter from their chamber at night, and often I saw them holding hands when they thought no one was near. Their love was a mystery to me, and yet it was part of our lives, a door that shut out the rest of us, a place inhabited by them alone. I would not like to have witnessed anyone say a bad word about my father in my mother's presence. She was fierce, and when I was very young, I wondered if she'd been bit by one of the werewolves in the stories she told me. I had seen her gazing at the moon, as such creatures are said to do, as if she recognized something up above us that was invisible to the human eye. My mother lit the candles on Friday night, but she did not pray. My father, on the other hand, was an extremely pious man. Though he was not welcome at the synagogue, he prayed in the yard every morning and at dusk. I would watch him sometimes, bowing to God, his voice like a river, rising up in shades of gold and blue. "Do you think God hears him?" my mother once asked me. I was only a boy, but she often asked me questions she might have posed to another adult. "I think he hears God," I said. My mother looked at me hard to see if I was making a joke. I wasn't. I thought perhaps it was more important to listen than to be heard. I kept a vigil into the night, listening to the moths at the window, the frogs in the puddles, the wind that came from across the ocean. My family's disagreement with the synagogue was the reason I attended school with people of color. Something so unusual, most of the students couldn't help but gape when my mother and Justine enrolled us. Justine was like an aunt to me, especially as we had no extended family on St. Thomas. Since I had few dealings with people of our own faith, I did not understand why the other students seemed so stunned by my